This is Maureen Kafkas, the Brain BS Coach, here to tell you about the episode today. In this episode, I interview Coach Jill Griffin. And this episode is so amazing in so many different ways. Number one, we're remembering 9/11, which is very important to me and Jill and should be to the rest of the country. We're also embodying what it's like to be maybe triggered a little bit like someone else's post on social media and actually make the very best out of it. I love this episode. Sit back, settle in. Episode number 158 of the Brain BS podcast, Remembering 9/11 with Jill Griffin. Do you want more out of your life, but not exactly sure what that might be? Are you longing for something, but can't quite put your finger on what it is? That is the universe speaking to you, and it is time to listen up. I'm your host, Maureen Kafkas, the Brain BS Coach. I created the Brain BS podcast to help people define what success means to them and show them how to get it. I help you to let go of fear and doubt and prepare your nervous system for success. I show you how to understand your own energy and to trust yourself to make all the decisions. If you are ready to go inward and stop looking outside yourself for all the answers, this is the podcast for you. Now let's get started. Hello and welcome back to the Brain BS podcast. I have a special guest here today, and I have a little story about how I actually met her. Her name's Jill Griffin. She's a New Yorker, and I had been planning to go on a trip to New York for the first time in a long time. And I was looking at where to stay and things to do. And I had posted in a coaching group about what I was looking for. And I had posted a picture of the Statue of Liberty. But something that I do when I look at art is the same thing I did when I posted that picture. I just look at the center of it. I don't really look at the whole picture. I've taken more art back because I found things in the picture that bugged me after I bought it. And so what happened was I posted a picture of the Twin Towers in the picture. And it was, well, we'll talk a little bit about it, how it made her feel, but she made me aware of it. And we ended up reaching out and having a conversation about it. And then she was nice enough to come on the podcast and share her story and about why she reacted to the picture the way she did. And I just think it's a really important conversation to have for all of you out there listening, because the way we handled ourselves is role model for how you might want to do it when somebody does something to trigger you or says something that you disagree with. We don't have to go in the cave and protect ourselves and get full of judgments. We can actually have adult conversations with one another. And then I'm going to explain to you how it really paid off for me. And okay, Jill, I'm going to let you go ahead and introduce yourself and let the audience know whatever it is you want them to know about you.
Thank you. So hello, everyone. I am Jill Griffin. I am an executive coach. And yes, Maureen and I are in the same coaching, one of the same coaching support groups where we share information. And I think, you know, as a New Yorker who lived through 9/11, my immediate math is 7 friends that perished that day or were murdered that day, depending on how you want to think about it. And just the subsequent impact of what has happened, which some of it is studied and some of it is not. But I think as a New Yorker, it's very ingrained in us. And I, to be clear, the picture was not just the Twin Towers. The picture was the Twin Towers disappearing. So they were there and then they go away. Like it showed the before skyline and the after skyline. And
in the picture that I posted, it did that?
Yeah, that's
I didn't even know that.
I know you did it.
Right?
So it wasn't just the Twin Towers, right?
Yes, I'm so glad that you're even
showing that they were disappearing. And I just felt, you know, there's a lot of discord and vitriol in our, you know, we're both in the US and our country right now. And I just feel like no one can hear each other through the anger. And I just felt that I had an opportunity for myself to express to you that, you know, because I'm in that group a couple of times a day. And because of the way it was, every time I was going into it, I was seeing that. And I'm like, I don't want to be reminded of, you know, a tragedy. I want to be reminded of the rebirth. I want to be reminded of where we've come from since then. And I'm reminded enough every September, right? As those of us in New York are. So I just felt that reaching out to you privately, not putting you on blast, not making you right or wrong, because you're not right or wrong. And I'm not right or wrong. It's just an feeling. But I felt that, gosh, if we who share very similar values and did the same training can't have a conversation and even agree to disagree, then what are we doing? Like, if we can't do this and this is our profession. And I was a little nervous about saying, reaching out to you. And I remember like wondering, like, I wonder when she's going to respond, if she's going to respond at all or all the things. And you just responded so beautifully. And here we are. So that's me.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, this is so crazy. I put those, are they GIFs or GIFs? I don't even know what you call them, but I put them on there.
Tomato, tomato. It's a hot debated topic.
I don't even press them to see what they do.
Yeah.
So actually just this conversation right here is me learning another lesson and being more mindful of what I'm posting, to be honest with you.
Yes.
Like I did not even realize it did that. I would be triggered by that too, for sure. So, okay. So it's interesting because you say that coaches should be able to have this conversation, and pretty evident in the coaching community that we can't.
No, yeah, and that's my ideal, right? That's my own opinion that like we have the training. If we're not leading the way, then, you know, in our own lives, then how can we expect others to, you know, take the coaching or take the principles of mindset and apply it into theirs when, if we can't even apply it in our own lives?
Yeah. So, all right. So when I got the message back from you, immediately I panicked for a second. And because I have this primary subconscious brain filter, that's like one of my lenses that I look at life, and it's ingrained in me since I was little, and I'm aware of it now, so I can actually deal with it. But the first thing thought was I did something wrong. Mm. Right. And I got that panicky feeling that I got when I was little, but because I've done so much work on this and becoming more aware, I was like, wait, let's just stop for a second and take a deep breath and let's like really look at this. And I gave myself, you know, a little bit of time, and I looked at it and I was like, I'm actually really glad that she told me she's triggered, because my intent is not to trigger people.
Right.
My intent was like to do fun stuff when I come to New York.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, you can see I'm an example of how you might not intentionally do something.
Yes.
That can trigger emotions in someone else, but you're, and I'm not, how do I put this? You're not accountable for how they feel about it, but you are accountable for what you put out there.
Yes.
And even if I didn't have this conversation with you and I became aware that the towers disappeared in the picture, I would be mortified that I had it on there and I would have removed it.
Right. Right. As opposed to a picture of, you know, New York City skyline pre-2001, not a big deal. It was the disappearing of the towers that was the trigger for me. And I also think that like where I was triggered and wondering, like, how do I phrase this in the most loving way possible and not make her wrong? Meaning she could say no. And, you know, knowing that you and I were talking today and just looking back to what I wrote to you, I wrote, would you be open to taking the post down? Here's why, right? And then I explained. And at the day that we had that conversation, there was also some news in the press about the re-victimization of the surviving families of 9/11. And because I had seven friends perish, they are also being re-victimized by some of the things that were going on at the time. If anyone's interested, go do your Googling. It's fine, right? You can look at what it was. But it was, I think, also a hot button for me. So knowing that I'm already triggered, which I don't know if this is scientifically true or mindset-wise true, but I also feel like I'm already triggered. So I'm also going to find additional triggers.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. You're like, this is what you're paying attention to. This is what you're focusing on. Right. So you're gonna see more of it. So yeah, but so what's interesting though, and we both did this, so kudos to us for actually embodying the work. We both got a little triggered, but then we took time to go inward and to respond instead of react.
Right. And not make the other person a villain.
Yeah.
And not be a victim. For both of us, like, I could have been the villain or the victim, and you could have been the villain or the victim.
Yeah, and it's so easy to do that. right? It's so easy to do that. Because I think for a split second, I was like, I was just trying to find fun things to do. These thoughts didn't actually come to my mind, but I think this is like, I was just trying to find fun things to do. But then I thought about it and it didn't take me long at all. And I was like, of course I'm going to take it down. And then I wanted to reach out and meet you and talk to you about it because I saw it as a real possibility of first connecting with you and apologizing in person and being role models for how things can start out dicey. Yeah. Or whatever you want to call it. And it doesn't have to stay that way. And you can find ways to connect with people, even if you do little things that triggers the other person, right? It doesn't have to be all or nothing that you just avoid those people.
Yeah. And I also want to be clear, because the nuance, I think, is that you didn't owe me an apology. To me, it's when I go bigger or global on this topic, there's a lot of people getting triggered based on differences of opinions about how things should be done. And when I make you wrong and then I become self-righteous, the conversation has stopped. We don't have an opportunity then to move forward from that. So again, you get to be you. You don't owe an apology. But the idea, I guess I felt internally that, like I said before, that we would have had shared values based on doing the same training, that mm-hmm. it would be good for me to practice and say, hey, you know, it would be a similar conversation if we're talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. There are times in which we're going to do things and step on it. Maybe we do need to apologize. Maybe we just need to create awareness, but holding space for the person who's saying, hey, that's a trigger and here's why. And not making them like, oh, they're a snowflake or they can't handle it. It's like, don't we all want to be just a little nicer and kinder to each other? Like,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. Which is why I wanted to apologize. It wasn't because I felt like I owed it to you or you were expecting it, but like, it felt good. Yeah. It felt good to have a conversation about it. I mean, there's very little I won't dig deeper into. And 9/11 is a huge thing that happened, right? It impacted a lot of people.
Yep.
There's still, when we got going in our conversation, we were talking about how it's still impacting people in a major way. Yes, it happened quite some time ago, but it is still, people are still reacting.
Absolutely.
To it, right? The people who haven't gone inward, haven't been able, you know, traumatized. And I think a lot of it, because it happened to so many people, it seems like when things happen to so many people, that people kind of, they minimize how they should be feeling by a certain point. Like they minimize the trauma and they kind of squash it when they think other people are moving on, like they should be moving on too. And that somehow, because it happened to more people, it's less significant, but it's no less significant to your nervous system.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, you talked about it still impacting people. Again, I don't work for the city. I don't have stats. Again, all Googleable if someone's interested. But when you have over 300 firefighters and servicemen and police officers die on the same day, that has, on top of the horror of how they died and the bravery and the courage that they went through, it also has the aftermath, because every firehouse you walk through, every firehouse you walk by to this day has a memorial in front. It also means that, you know, for the months and years after, we were understaffed in certain areas, because you got to make up the whole of 300 and some odd men and women who are no longer here that were doing a job, right? So there's still the reverberation of what happens in that. And then the same thing with, you know, it's just under 3,000 people who died that day. You know, I know people who were in the towers that survived and got out. They have survivor's guilt. They have drug and alcohol problems. They are, you know, in challenges with their primary family, within divorcing. And, you know, so the impact of a terrorist attack is beyond just the day of. It's the continuation of a community that is trying to heal. But at the same time, you know, people were mentally, physically hurt. And I know we talk a lot about the immediate deaths and then the subsequent deaths after, but I don't know, you know, there are people like John Stewart who's done a phenomenal job of shining a light on the amount of first responders who have had enormous health issues, and many of them have died from the cancer from all of the, you know, the burning materials in which they're breathing in. I don't know the numbers there, but it's by no means a small amount of people that have died post those, you know, with those conditions. And then also, you know, like I said, the drug and alcohol situation that I don't believe is studied, but in my little awareness of understanding as being a New Yorker, I know a lot of people who they'll say in the right place and time, you know, like I know someone who said I went outside for a cigarette and that saved my life. So for me, smoking's a good thing. And like, they know that that's not necessarily a rational thought, but for them, that's how they deal with the PTSD, that they stepped outside at the right time. And in their mind, they're alive today because of it. People need help. And we don't always know how to provide the help or know how to hold space for those people. And of course, we're not therapists and trauma counselors. So, you know, people have to either raise their hand or help, like loved ones have to help them get help. But that's still, it still is impacting people.
Yeah. So how do you think it's impacting you and the way you're doing your coaching business? How do you think it's impacted that? And how do you think it's, does it have an impact on you on a daily basis? Or how do you think it's impacting your life now?
It's a great question. It does not have an impact on me on a daily basis anymore. And if anybody was in New York that day or is a New Yorker, you know what I'm talking about when I say the September air, right? September and October in New York are gorgeous. The humidity is gone. The sky is like the bluest, gorgeous, most blue that you can imagine. It's crisp air, but it's still warm. So the sensation of that air, the sensation of the weather, I've heard many people, including myself, saying, oh, it feels like 9/11, because there's this almost like paradox or cognitive dissonance that it was one of the most gorgeous weather days possible, yet equally so horrific, right? So I think that's one. So I feel like most years, usually after Labor Day, I start to like, oh, right, we're coming up to the anniversary. You know, as far as what I've done since then, I mean, I worked for a few years in the rebuilding of the World Trade Center. So sitting in the office and looking down onto the reflection pools and that area, you know, you go out for lunch and you walk past the memorial. I personally haven't gone to the memorial. I've supported it and helped it get built, but maybe someday, but I don't necessarily need to go into the memorial. I know what happened. I lived through it. But I often, depending on where I am and how the memorial is set up, I'll look for my friends' names on the wall and just give it a little touch. And because they're all engraved in marble, so I'll run my fingers across their names. And to me, that's just a way of like, you know, how do you honor, reflect, and remember? So moving past the anger and the hate and into, you know, the love of keeping my various friends' names alive and honoring their memory. And I think when you and I talked about a friend or two, you know, just in that same spirit of like, let's remember them, the way we would with any death that we want to talk about. You know, we grieve because we loved, right? So how do you grieve it? As far as my coaching today, I think, between those events and then, I subsequently had a traumatic brain injury. It's like, yay. Oh, God. So in the months post 9/11, I went hiking to Australia by myself and I fell and had a traumatic brain injury. And it was, you know, pretty arduous journey working through some of the nuances. So I bring that up through the lens of trauma, where I do think I have a very keen understanding of physical trauma. And I look at the 9/11 as being the physical trauma, you know, because you're feeling the sensations or you're smelling the city. I can drop into scent memory like that and go back to the way the city smelled in the days following, and like when the wind would change and you could smell, of course, the rubble. You know, just being really sensitive to trauma. Also, brain injuries, depending on how they happen, are invisible disabilities. And the idea that, you know, if you're, my work as an executive coach is often also, in addition to working with people individually, is also going into organizations. And if I go into an organization and I don't see anyone visually disabled, it's also tells me a lot about the culture. So when something like 62% of the workforce will have had or does have an invisible disability, that again, high touch understanding of what it's like to have a challenge that because you don't see it, you think that everything's fine. You don't know that I need accommodation. I have to constantly advocate for myself. You know, that's a journey too, to constantly be advocating when someone can't see it. So I think those are the ways in which it shows up in my work, in which I really understand that. I mean, I joke and say, like, my parents and my husband, they love me, but they forget. Because I can represent so able and capable, and they forget that I have a disability. And then there are days where they're like, oh, you're not having a good day. And I'm like, why? Because I'm falling over, tripping, and I'm slurring my words? No, I'm not having a good day. So just, you know, again, holding space for that and just having, I think, a keen connection and understanding of physical trauma and how to move past it. I would say that's how it impacts my work today. That, again, that's not the primary work I do. The primary work I do, again, is executive coaching and team dynamics work. But a lot of people have trauma there too, whether it's physical or emotional, based on, you know, dynamics of the office place and the workplace.
Oh, yeah. One of the things that I've really been focusing on this past year is unacknowledged trauma. We all have it. And then you have all, like, a whole city that was impacted by a very big trauma that was very well known and acknowledged, but also all the unacknowledged trauma and everybody before that even happened, and that's happened since then. But I'm really glad that you brought up invisible disabilities, because it made me think of a book by Susan Page, Why Talking Is Not Enough. I posted about it many times. One of the first 8 loving actions she has of how to approach marriage, but I think this pertains to all relationships, is adopting a spirit of goodwill. Another way of saying that, I think, is to give people the benefit of a doubt. So when you're going into interactions and trauma can be physical, emotional, or mental, and we might not see it at all. Yeah. So you might see people behaving in a way that you really disapprove of, or you think they shouldn't be doing it, but you can always go a little deeper to question, maybe why might that be happening for them? Yeah. Because that's the 8th loving action, is practice compassion and empathy and understand that everybody comes from a different standpoint. So if somebody gives you feedback that you did something that triggered them or, you know, activated something in them, like, be open to hearing about it and what it is that you did, and like, live and learn, right? Like, I don't want to make that mistake. And I do view it as a mistake because it wasn't my intention. I don't want to do that again. But also, I know that I've been doing this work and I'm a good person and my heart's in the right place. So I'm not beating myself up over it either, or wishing that I didn't. I kind of capitalized on it, right? I did something I didn't like, and then I met you. And then you gave me great tips.
And then you had a New Yorker's tour of New York.
You
did.
Like,
listen, here's what you need to do, where you need to go, what you need to see. Come see my city.
Honestly, she gave me the best list, and we did a lot of the stuff on it. But the best, and I posted on this on social media, was Brandy's, which I shouldn't have said the name on here, or everyone's going to go there. But it's a piano bar on the Upper East Side that Jill told me about. And since I was celebrating 60 on that trip, I was willing to stay up late, which I never do. And we went to this piano bar And oh my God, the waitress in there did actually a tour and was the star in Mamma Mia. And I got to hear her sing in a piano bar for 2 drink minimum in this really cozy little environment. And it was an absolute blast and all right. these other fun things. So I just point this out because when we talk about in the coaching world or in business or whatever, when you create abundance within you and you attract more of it to you. So I ended up doing something that I, you know, was questionable for me. I owned it. I decided to get on a conversation, make it right. And I received so much abundance for doing it. That was literally one of the funnest New York trips I've ever had. And it felt really good to be able to have you come on the podcast for this to air on 9/11, because as I've said in other places, I was a salty sea captain in another lifetime. I haven't done a past life regression yet, but I know I was off the East Coast. My husband's like convinced of it. And I just absolutely love New York City. I love the energy of it. I love the people there. It's just a really special place, in my opinion. And I know it's big and huge and be dirty and crazy, but there's no place else like it.
Right, right. Yeah. And again, go to the tourist places because there's a reason why they're the tourist places. And then get out and go explore into the neighborhoods, into the cities, and find, you know, the little gem of eating establishments that are in the neighborhoods that people live in. That's what you got to do.
It was awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you think we should talk about in this episode? Is there anything, I don't know if this is possible, but is there anything any of us all can do for New Yorkers like this time of year? Like how can we do something collectively from an energetic standpoint that
can be beneficial? You know, there's a lot of charities. If that feels right for you, there's the Widow and Children's Fund of the 300 plus firefighters and officers that, you know, need support. There's the, Tunnel to Towers Run, which is, one of the firemen who actually, if you don't know the geography, it's kind of hard to understand, but we're, honoring his track because he was in New Jersey, but close enough to New York that he saw it happen. And all public transportation had shut down. So he ran on foot and, you know, unfortunately perished as a result, but he did serve. So there's charity that way. There's the World Trade Center Registry, which myself and many other New Yorkers are in. And, you know, even giving to causes in your own backyard, in your own area about, you know, how do we create more understanding of each other and each other's cultures? So that, I mean, I think that's another beautiful way of honoring the memory, so that we're honoring the differences in our cultures and not making it hate. We know after 9/11, many people who had certain names or looked a certain way were really aggressively discriminated against. So I also think understanding the people in your community that maybe have different cultures than you and look different than you and have a different sounding name than you do, that there's opportunity there in your own local environment to support and get curious by going to a Sikh, or mosque or meeting with Sikhs, right? There's lots of different ways that you can get involved and honor, you know, again, one of outside of Pearl Harbor, I mean, one of the greatest tragedies on America's soil. So I think there's lots of ways that we can continue to support people. And then just also like, you know, in recent years, I've done a lot of work with Gold Star moms, who are the women whose children died or were murdered in action in war, you know, military families. And, you know, one of the greatest things that I've learned, again, because of this idea of just my, I think, personal understanding of trauma, is that often they just want to talk about their son or daughter and want to be listened to. And it's not necessarily talk about the day or the tragedy. It's talk about who they were as a person. And I think the same thing, if you meet someone who has experience or has some closeness to 9/11, it's not again about the horror of the day, but it's asking about like, so tell me about that person. What were they like? You know, what should we know about them? And so that we can all hold sort of their memories. And I think just a lot of people want to talk about their loved ones and not talk about the actual tragedy, but talk about who they were as a spirit and as a person.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. So do you think you could give me the links to some of those you mentioned. Yes. We could put that in the show notes. And I like what you said too about, it's like really about community. Like we're all in this together. And yes, we need to take care of our own needs, but also we need to take care of each other because nobody else is going to do it.
Nobody ain't going to do it. Exactly.
No, our healthcare system, our government, nothing is set up to really truly take care of the emotional and mental health needs that other people have. And just building community and taking care of one another is the way to do it. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was awesome having you on here. And thank you for all the suggestions in New York.
I love it. Thank you for having me and creating, you know, the space to just be so loving and supportive that you created that space. So I thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay, audience, I know you learned something valuable here today. I'll see you next episode. Thanks for being here and learning about Brain BS. I hope you enjoyed listening to the episode as much as I enjoyed creating it for you. If you did, please take a little time to do a quick review, give me 5 stars, and share it with everyone you know. If you're actually interested in being on the podcast yourself or have questions about it, you can find me in the Brain BS podcast community on Facebook. See you next time.